I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a radio conversation with linked-up literate listeners who write at radioopensource.org. Privileged to be talking this hour with the prose enchantress Edna O'Brien. Her new novel, laying out the fierce attachment of a mother and daughter who repel each other, is titled The Light of Evening. Her life work, starting with The Country Girls in 1960, is a compendium of all the pleasures we associate with reading modern fiction, among them music, emotional precision, and daring, virtuosic sentence-making. Pour yourself a cup of tea and join the conversation with Edna O'Brien at www.radioopensource.org. Welcome to Open Source, Edna O'Brien. I'm in the spell of this novel, The Light of Evening, which extends the story of exile, a writer's exile. It wasn't just from the west of Ireland that you fled in a way to London. It was from Mum. What is it about writers leaving home?
Well, it's many things. I think you have to leave. First of all, you do not want that enveloping sense of matrix. It could be father as well, but of family or people you know. Because writing, while you're doing it, is so secret. It's also from the unconscious. I don't know what I'm going to write when I sit down to write. Mm. And if compounded with that is somebody, for better or for worse, telling you you must not do it, that's the first reason. But there's another reason and a deeper one. The places or the people that we like and love, but I'm also have some reservations about, those places are best seen from afar. Wordsworth talked about emotions recollected in tranquility. I'm not sure about the tranquility, but I certainly know that if I had remained in County Clare, which is the fount and source, truly, of all my writing, it's so powerful for me. The landscape itself, both geographically and psychically, is like animate. It's like a character in my book. It has given me a lot, but I had to leave. First of all, young people want to leave. That's true. People all over any country, you read that, young people all want to go to cities. Chekhov's phrase, Moscow, 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 is true. And secondly, my actual mother, my mother, had a great repulsion regarding the written word, or revulsion is a better word. She felt, without knowing, that literature was tantamount to sinning, that literature was a bit of a route to downfall. And she might have read Molly Bloom in a previous incarnation. She certainly never read it in her natural life. So she very much wanted me to be something else. She also felt, with justification, that writers show up not wanting to betray their environment, but they want to explore it and to excavate it. And I have sometimes said, when I am, you know, people are cross with me for writing, or Irish people, so are other critics. But sometimes they say, why do I tell these stories that have a lot of darkness in them? And I say, as a writer, I want to get the beauty of life, but I also want to get the subsoil. I want to turn that soil over and find anything that I can find. It's not necessarily dirt. It's what I call truth. Mm. And many people take issue with that.
God knows you've found a lot of it in this new book. The new book is about a writer named Eleonora and her mother named Delia, known as Dilly. I mean, there are tremendous resemblances that we don't need to belabor between the story and your own life. You left Ireland in the 50s.
In the late 50s, yes.
Yes, and you had a job in a pharmacy as Eleonora did, and you didn't know at that point that there was a great writing career ahead. In the novel, I wish you'd read, to me, one of innumerable gorgeous, gorgeous passages on page 141 about how Eleonora, in London, with a married man, and in a certain kind of disgrace back home, by indirection, finds that she's writing.
Yes, I will, and then we'll talk. As the weeks and months went by, she began to write. Nothings, or next to nothings, nettles, hens laying out, or the cackle of geese and their glee at being allowed into the stubble and gorging themselves on the leavings of wheat and barley. Her mother came into everything she wrote, and she remembered once in a guest house that unspoken covenant that had passed between them. It was a guest house due to be opened, and the owner, Cecilia, had asked them as a great favour to come so that she could rehearse her skills. In a newly papered parlour with gilt chairs, a pot of tea with a strainer, and a china slop bowl, Sissy, eager to serve, was practising her etiquette, her sir and her madam, pressing on them scones and sandwiches and a fresh sponge cake, still warm, and from which the raspberry jam oozed out of the two sandwiched halves, debating aloud how much she could charge for high teas. At one point, when Sissy ran to get some other dainty, they looked at the intricate crimson needlework of Christ, with a motto embroidered on it in looped lettering, and her mother asked her, like a good girl, read that verse aloud. Christ is the unseen guest at every table, the silent listener to every conversation, she read. Her mother, thereby inferring that she too, mother, would be the unseen guest and the silent listener to every conversation her daughter would have.
Edna Bryan, that's just a start, but it's a gorgeous start and a fascinatingly, I think, sinister Irish twist on the verse about Jesus, but we're going to come back to all of that. The novelist Edna O'Brien, whose new book is called The Light of Evening, is our guest on Open Source. We'll be right back. Let's talk about the meaning that begins around that story, this haunting presence of a mother who's kind of a spy, kind of an inspiration, kind of a goad. What's happening here?
It's deep water. It's deep bog. I think one's mother, and certainly my mother, has the most abiding and all-pervasive effect on one. We know our mothers very well, and we don't know them at all. That's a paradox, but it's a truth. In the case of the paragraph that I just read, the mother is taking on, if you like, partly the role of the Christ, the unseen, who is there, who is always watching, always judging, and doing it really not out of malice, doing it because she believes that she must keep watch over her daughter. One of the prayers I had when we were young was to the guardian angel. O angel of God, my guardian dear, to whom God's love commits me here. Ever this day be at my side, to light and guard, to rule and guide. If my mother, God rest her, was sitting here, she would say that would also be her agenda. The obvious one, but it's not as simple as that. There is as well, and we know it in our lives, in our workplaces, in everything, matter of control. Many people, I am not one of them, I have many failings, but it's not control. Many people love to control. And mothers, for the most part, do. And I think, you're lucky to be a man, but we can go into this later. I think they have more determined to control their daughters than their sons. Hmm. I was a willing species for control because I was very, I loved my mother and I still do. I regard The Light of Evening as a book of love, and not Richard Eyre introducing me in New York the other night said it was a book full of rage and reconciliation. And I was very glad that he said reconciliation, because if it were a book of rage, it wouldn't be worth writing. But there are very fierce things in it, and a fierce journal addressing the mother. Sometimes I wonder, so you can bring me back to what you're about to ask me.
No, we should all learn to wander the way you do. The book, the ending of the book is a kind of collection of letters that the mother had written to the daughter over many years. She wrote a Sunday night epistle. It was news, gossip, chiding, miss you, father's misbehavior, animals on the place. I mean, it was a little bit of everything. In all this estrangement, in all this tension, there was a grappling attachment, and it turns out she wanted the daughter to have the beloved property too. I mean, it was, I don't know, it's profoundly mysterious. Rage, reconciliation in spades, on steroids, as we say.
My mother wrote me letters at least two or three times a week, and it was very hard for her because, you know, she was working hard. These letters I'd never read with a calm soul or a calm mind, but I read them when she was dead, and I realized they were brilliant bulletins.
We're going to sample them after a short break. We're talking with the Irish novelist Edna O'Brien and her new book, The Light of Evening. This is Open Source from PRI.
Hi, this is Brendan. I'm the Open Source blogger-in-chief. I am, as we all are right now, eating too many cookies. Open Source is taking a week off before the new year. We offer, in place of our live bodies, Poetry and Prose Week, a series of four conversations with some of our favorite authors. We will return on January 2nd with a show about world-changing, a book full of solutions for all of the world's problems. The book is, by the way, carbon neutral, meaning that it has matched its carbon footprint with carbon offsets. This and many other things explained for you at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Light, and this is Open Source. We're talking with Edna O'Brien, the Irish novelist of huge proportions and many, many books now, some criticism, some biography, but mostly this ravishingly beautiful and difficult fiction about women, most especially, and especially country girls from the west of Ireland. In The Light of Evening, as you say, rage and reconciliation with a mother of a rather scandalous daughter who's gone to London and written about things that nice Irish girls aren't supposed to write about. The mother, your mother actually inked out on the page words that she didn't think you should have writ. But in the novel, it turns out there's a trove of letters from the mother, written Sunday evenings, to her daughter in London, where she thought she had, you know, fallen into every kind of vice. Would you give us a sample?
Sure. The irony is that my mother, who disapproved of writing, was herself an embryonic writer.
Oh, boy.
So she gave me the gift, and I certainly believe that, without knowing she had given it to me.
Hmm.
This is one of the letters. We got two new pups, mischief makers. I had left clothes on the line all night, the ground in the morning pure white like it had snowed. They had got to work on the sheets and the pillow slips, chewed them to bits. I could have killed them. The chimneys are full of crow's nests, even though they were cleaned last spring. They clawed the pots off. We are 4 weeks sitting up close to an oil heater, and the paraffin gives off a foul smell. Yes, your brother thinks Roisin is his, all settled. His wife is the one driving him on, though he was born selfish. If he got it, you or your children would never be let inside even the bottom gate. So vexed was he last Christmas night that he drove away from here and killed one of the pups, and we cried and cried. He didn't even stop, only drove on and didn't tell us until we found out about it for ourselves. Some have nature and some have not. The comrade of the dog mourned her pal. We couldn't get her into the kitchen to warm her. And even now, when she hears a dog barking in the distance, she listens to see where the sound is coming from. Your father weeps, and so do I. The paling around the house is all rusty, and the posts will take 40 pounds worth of paint. That house you thought you might buy, Gore House, is a disaster. We brought a man that knows all about timbers. He says it's only fit to demolish. Roof also rotten. A German man brought it many years ago, but never came back. He saw it from the air. So forget about buying a Jew. I'd like you to persevere. Persevere and build here, near us, in the kitchen garden, an old stone wall all around you. No price for cattle nowadays, people killing their own beef, as most have got deep freezers. Do you recall the leak above your bed in the blue room when you were last here? Well, I woke and saw a light shining, and I couldn't believe it, and went across and found the light on, though the switch was off. And when I went to turn it off, I felt a current. I got so alarmed that I rang Graham. And the creature came up here at midnight and found the carpet and the boards all wet, all rotten, and said, lucky I didn't stand on that very spot, or now I'd be in kingdom come. Your brother has never said would I or his father like a drive in one of their two cars, but he isn't worth worrying about.
This is a letter from Dilly back in County Clare to her naughty daughter in London. This doesn't sound like an embryonic writer. This sounds like the real thing. And can I also say it reminds me uncannily, it's another connection with Philip Roth. Philip Roth says his father was a novelist who never wrote. As an observer of detail, a man of memory, a compiler of history, Philip feels he got a great deal of his education from his father, who never wrote a thing. Was your mother, I mean, did she really write this sort of prose to you, this sort of stream of consciousness?
Oh, yes, and even, you know, at random we picked one, even more telling than that. She would say, like, I got shaky on a stepladder or whatever yesterday. I was painting a ceiling for you. I know you like a painted ceiling. You mentioned one, the Vatican ones. That photograph of you does not do you justice. People here say they will sue you for your books. Dead people will also sue you. So they ran in a gallop from anecdote to reproval to lyricism. They're marvelous. And the sad thing is, and this is something, and we can't talk about exile about anything, but the sad thing is I never fully appreciated them in her lifetime because there was fear in me. Fear is one of the worst emotions. Fear drives out love. It doesn't kill it, but it puts it, if you like, in a back room of the mind. Because reading the letters, when I sat down to write The Light of Evening, I wanted to write about my mother, not as a memoir, but with the range and freedom and wildness, if you like, of fiction. I wanted to imagine her life as a young woman, young girl with long hair and flat shoes and an oilskin bag for a suitcase coming to Boston. And along with that, then, I wanted to write a parallel of sort of my own life, influenced by my mother, of course, that goes without saying, but also on the run from her. And then somehow to bring all those letters in. So making the story work was like, and this I don't wish to sound conceited, but it was like bringing five different, very different stories under the one roof.
Let me say parenthetically, there is a wonderful American story here, and everybody remarks on how cinematic it is. It'll make a great movie of Dilly, the mother, coming to Brooklyn, not Boston, in the 20s. It was not a happy beginning, and it didn't end happily either. She said she found America, she said, a land of bluff and blighted dreams. And she left saying, I would be a biddy, a kitchen canary, a house servant. And she left it all behind. There's an unfinished chapter in the O'Brien story. Do you ever wonder about the American might have been, or is that a
yes,
is that your comment on it?
I wonder if she had stayed and married a gentleman from these shores, I would have grown up in Brooklyn and written novels set in a city. As it happens, she went back to Ireland, and my novels are grounded in the west of Ireland, and I'm lucky for that. I'll tell you why. It's much easier to write landscape, country landscape, than city. You have more to draw on. It's like more wells in the ground, you know, to dig from. And my mother...
You don't have the slightest doubt that you would have been a writer.
Oh, I would love place. To have been something else, like an ice skater or something with movement, but that's a fantasy. My mother didn't actually think of it as a land of blighted dreams. It was a trainee nurse who said that to her because she had already been in America for a time. And indeed, it is both a land of dreams and a land of blighted dreams. You have only to look around you. There is no such thing as a golden overall picture of any country. Mm. But for Irish people, at that time, coming to America was tantamount to coming to a kind of paradise. And there was no reality between what happened to the people who came and the notion of those at home waiting for the envelope to come with a bit of money. Hmm. And their journey was always arduous because they traveled, and they also owed money because in the case of my mother, like a lot of other people, they had to borrow, you know, pennies and shillings for the boat fare, even though she traveled down below. So that it was a huge breach. And at the same time, you mentioned earlier about exile. They always, I think, felt or believed that the person would return home. When I left Ireland, see, there's many kinds of exile. And I think writers by nature, and if Philip Roth were sitting here, he might even nod in agreement, regardless of where they live, whether they live in their hometown or in splendor or in an ivory tower or in a lunatic asylum, which I do not rule out in my own case. Regardless of where they live, there is an inner exile. To want to write is, and I am not joking when I say this, an unnatural action. It sometimes is very rewarding, but it is the person, for the most part, observing, as you said earlier, watching, noticing the smell of a flower, the smell of a cow dung, doesn't have to be a smell. Every sense has to be alert all the time. Eyes, ears, and noticing a sky on the way here this evening, I saw the most beautiful bit of lilac sky for a second, always noticing, but ultimately having to go into the cave of the self and the unconscious. And that is a form of exile. My exile from my country wasn't just that. I wanted to go to get away because I feared I would be stopped or I would be, nobody would say you can't write. But if you know that somebody is there evaluating and judging and criticizing, that's why on quite another level, when a book comes out, it's very often a bit of a trial having to bear things that are said about one.
Well, that's why it has to be good. So many questions about writing. The first question or the comment posted on our site when we said you were coming from Jay Dyer asked how you read Philip Roth these days. He has introduced you to a great many American readers. What do you make of his last wave of very serious, sometimes deeply tragic or introspective American books, sort of trumping his young career as a comic?
Well, he's still a comic, that's for sure. He will always be a comic as well. I think his last wave, as you call them, of books, I think they're very powerful and I think they're very important. And they are one of the voices of one of America. There are many voices, you see. Every writer is the voice, or should be, and indeed Philip is, of an aspect of his or her country, or a part of the country. And he certainly has that. I think he cannot but be comic at moments. Every man was not. But then it wasn't intended to be, and it wouldn't be called, the theme was not. But what he has, he's a very serious writer, of course, and his skills, he has honed his gifts and his language to just the absolute right pitch.
Yeah, we couldn't agree more. It's wonderful to hear you talk about writing. And I want to extend it, actually. I mean, your book, The Light of Evening, is a book about writing. It's about, clearly from your mother you had a talent. Clearly in the old church sense you had a vocation. But then you had to learn. And I wish we'll talk about that. In the book you talk about the great heroes, and I'm going to ask you to spell them out. But first, just to say, you're listening to Open Source. You write in The Light of Evening about how a young woman from the west of Ireland in London comes under the spell of the Bronte sisters, Virginia Woolf, Thackeray, Jonathan Swift, Chekhov, Dickens, Flaubert, Thomas Mann. I mean, this is all the reading I'm going to have to do for the rest of my life, is sort of catch up with the writers who formed you. Who were your great exemplars, and most especially in what you're famous for, the study of the female heart and the female voice?
It's a big question. Have we 2 hours or have we 10 minutes?
We'll give it 3 weeks.
We'll give it 3 weeks. I think the writer I have learned most from is male, but that doesn't matter because he's James Joyce. Mm-hmm. And James Joyce spoke of Leopold Bloom, as that womanly man. Mm. I think, ideally, a great writer is androgynous, is man and woman. Mm-hmm. I do, of course, write more about women, and I always probably will. But to go to the influences for a moment, reading good and great things is essential for a writer. I read every day of my life something of Shakespeare or something from St. John's Gospel or a poem of Gerard Manley Hopkins, doesn't matter, because it's like an athlete training. That is where you get that spur to go to the table where one works. At the same time, reading great people, it's so companionable. The books I have read and scenes, moments from them, from Proust, from Chekhov, from anyone, are as vital to me and as strong in my memory as moments with real people.
Yes.
Now, you might say, or a stranger or a listener might say, oh, well, you're supposed to be writing about things in life. Why are you escaping into books? And I would rebut that and say that great fiction or great drama cuts deeper and truer and more unflinchingly and more movingly into human passions, human interchange, than many humans ever dare to do. And in my own case, you mentioned something else, I think when I did escape the matrix of homeland, home, mother and all else, writing those books were to me like, they were like, or the idea of books, they were like mantras. They were like something I could hold on to. And my first book that I ever bought cost 4 pence, and it was called Introducing James Joyce by T.S. Eliot. I worked in this chemist shop in Dublin, and I had 1 half-day a month, and I had no money, 2 very relevant matters. And the people were very trusting in those days. Outside a bookshop, there was a stall with second-hand books, which you could pick up and read, and I picked up one and read a few lines. And it was like, I'll never forget this. It was like complete transport for me. Mm. Transport of thought and of everything. It was a description of a Christmas dinner in Portrait of the Artist, starting off very happily and enchantingly with the table laid, fire, all the things on the table, the blue flame, lit flame of plum pudding, everything about it. And you knew that this could not go as utterly perfectly as Joyce had prepared it. And when I read that, I thought, ah, yes, if I'm going to write, there's one place I must keep with, the very place I came from. So there is a paradox or a contradiction in my nature as well as in my experience. The very place that I ran from is also the source of my fertility.
Wow. And then comes the moment when you dare to take up the trade that he did. Our guest is Edna O'Brien. Her new book is called The Light of Evening. We're talking about reading, writing books on Open Source from PRI. We'll be right back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking with Edna O'Brien, the Irish novelist, whose career began with a certain notoriety. That's 40-some years ago. Her new book, The Light of Evening, is a sort of classic. And she's a central figure in the canon now, not only of Irish literature, but of women's literature. Rebecca Phelan joins us from Dublin this evening. She's a professor of English at University College in Dublin, and she's been reading and writing about Edna O'Brien for a long time. Rebecca Phelan, I'm interested in Ireland today and its view of Edna O'Brien and Edna O'Brien's Ireland of 30, 40 plus years ago. Has Ireland come to accept Edna O'Brien's tale of itself?
Thankfully, yes, it has. I mean, for some of us, Edna O'Brien has been one of the most important writers in Ireland for a very long time. But I think it is the case that as Ireland itself has changed radically over the last few years, there have been changes in the literary landscape as well. And thankfully, one of those changes is that finally she's beginning to get the recognition that she deserves. You have to realise that the earlier Edna O'Brien, I think, was somebody... Ireland is a very strange place, as Edna herself knows, and the notion that a slip of a girl in the 60s and 70s would have the audacity to actually talk about great writers and include herself in that kind of company wasn't well received at all. So she wasn't well received, actually, really very little had to do with how she wrote, because she's always been a fantastic writer. But the bad reception had a lot more to do with really superficial elements in relation to Ireland as a culture and Ireland as a country, political as well as other ways. Well, so like Joyce, she's perfectly right insofar as she followed, in fact, Joyce's footsteps. Joyce also lived in self-imposed exile, of course, for most of his life. But in fact, Ireland, particularly Dublin, in his case, remained the centre and source of everything that he wrote about.
What is the judgment in the hindsight of the modern Ireland, the Celtic Tiger, of these rather fantastic tales of women imprisoned by their families, by the church, by themselves, by our culture in Ireland until yesterday?
Yeah, you see, in so many ways, there's a body of work that exists, say, between 1970 and 1995, which would be called, I suppose, overtly or explicitly political writing by women, much of which attacked institutions like the church and the family as it existed in Ireland. And sadly, what was ignored in much of that was that people like Edna O'Brien, and in fact Kate O'Brien before her, had written about these things in their own way long before the second wave of the women's movement provided a platform for women writers to do it. Edna O'Brien will always stand out in my mind as somebody who, initially when I first started working on her short stories in particular in the mid-80s, I can remember giving a conference paper in Melbourne in Australia and a middle-aged couple coming up to me afterwards and the woman saying, "Oh, I love her writing, but my husband won't read her." And her husband was there, and I said, "Why will you not read her?" And he said, "Because it reminds me of reading my sister's diaries." And he was put off by the fact that he felt she was very much a woman who was writing for women. And I think that has drastically changed. There's a number of different reasons why it has changed. But I think for me, one of the interesting things was opening, reading something like a Pagan Place, or I think it's an excerpt, I can't quite remember whether it's A Rose in the Heart of New York, which is one of my favourite stories, or
yes,
A Scandalous Woman. But where O'Brien is writing about a very early and crude form of contraception, for instance, where the child narrator or the young narrator is aware of the fact that her mother is inserting tissue paper into her private parts before she kind of goes across the landing to do her duty. And to us these days, that certainly in terms of what the sorts of women's writing that has appeared in the last 30 years as a result of the second wave of the women's movement, that doesn't seem to be particularly radical. But when you contextualise that, when it was written, and the kind of environment that it was written from within, that is incredibly radical. Not just in terms of women, but in terms of talking about conditions for the human condition in Ireland at that particular time. Nobody was talking about those things. No writer was writing about those things. And to actually suggest that women in Ireland, in Catholic Ireland, were disobeying the church, even in such a crude form, simply wasn't being spoken about. So there's always been an edge to O'Brien's fiction that has had an honesty and, in some people's eyes, a brutality that kind of marked her in a way. People wanting, critics, when I say people, I think readers have always loved her. Critics wanting, in a way, to distance themselves from that kind of hard truth.
I like the point about honesty.
Yes.
And again, going back to Philip Roth, he says, O'Brien writes about women without a taint of ideology or, as far as I can see, any concern for taking a correct position, then
yes.
or now. Edna O'Brien, what do you make of modern Ireland, the money, the Celtic tiger, the culture, when you go back?
Is Rebecca gone?
No.
Rebecca, you may have to help me here. Well, the Celtic tiger, as Rebecca knows and everybody knows, it exists and it's sometimes now called the Celtic kitten, I gather, when finances. It's very much part of life in the cities more than in the country. I mean, Dublin especially. Dublin is...
Have you seen that mall outside Limerick?
Well, Limerick is a city too, but there are other things in Limerick as well, which if you read the papers, there's a great contrast in Ireland. There's the Celtic tiger or whatever, and there's still a lot of poverty. There's a lot of drugs, like in any city. And what is sometimes, you know, written about isn't... There are other things to explore. I think in relation to Ireland, or as a writer, I want to still retain in my fictions what is primal about Ireland and as then embody what is contemporary about Ireland. Mm. If one is to just write about the contemporary and obvious thing, it's fine, and one could write maybe a very nice editorial, but it's not the stuff of fiction. And when I go back to Ireland, as I do a lot, and Rebecca and I met in Galway a few months ago, people in the country have still a great yearning and quite a loneliness and things that are much more interesting and native to fiction and to drama than the hurdy-gurdy and glitzy. There's nothing wrong with the glitzy life of the city. And Ireland has more, you know, it has wonderful attraction. I was astonished to read of the number of stag parties that take place in hotels in Dublin, all from England, because the Irish have, they're very gregarious, and they're even more gregarious now with a bit of money. But it's only a part of the story. There is still, and what I like about being Irish is that great undertow of emotion and feeling. If you go...
And language, if I may.
Oh, language, number one. If you go to Shannon Airport, where I go a lot, you still see what I don't think you see in other parts of the world. People... This welter of emotion at people being either separated or united. Mm. They're not ashamed of it. I like that. I don't, for instance, one of the words I most object to in this world has nothing to do with Ireland, to do with the world, is cool. Why should people be cool? Why should we conceal what matters to us? I don't think people should go around the street weeping and gnashing. But I do think that there has arisen a great fear in the so-called, in the modern world, in the so-called cool, about being honest with each other. The world we live in, the manipulation, not just in Ireland, in this country as well, the manipulation of facts and language in politics and everything is terrible. It's taking, it's draining the very sap and truth out of life. So, sorry, I wandered again.
No, we should wander the way you do. I go back to Shannon, too, and I always listen for that primal, that... What are the elements of it? There is a... First of all, it's the language, but a kind of contact with myth, imagination, music, the antique, the ancestral. Rebecca, do we kid ourselves that it's there in a kind of special dose?
No, and I don't think we do kid ourselves. I think it is. It certainly still is throughout Ireland, but I think Edna is quite right in saying that it's more obvious in the country. Although I originally come from Belfast and I've just lived for the last 4 years in Galway, and I have to say that I'm much more aware. I'm back in Dublin now, obviously, but I'm much more aware these days of an east-west division. And one of the jokes in the West is that the Celtic tiger never quite got to the West because it wouldn't get its feet wet crossing the Shannon.
Connemara.
There is a slight sense in which the West is, you know, it's not just about the country, but I think there is a division in the land, which is very obvious these days. When you do cross the Shannon, for instance, and you go into the West, the psyche there is still, I think it's still a wounded psyche, to be honest with you, much more so than is evident in the cities in the East, like such as Dublin, for instance. And I think there's also a rawness, I suppose, in parts of Ireland still. There is, I mean, going back to Edna's writing not that long ago, for instance, I mean, the whole notion of begrudgery, which manifests itself in different countries, that if somebody just gets too big for their boots, they simply have to be cut down, was very much applied to her, I think, because of her success elsewhere. She was set, and also, of course, the notion that what she was doing was being brutally honest about Ireland, the political, social, and psychological conditions of Ireland for both men and women. But she was writing about that for an audience that, you know, people in America and England were buying these stories and books. And it's, there is that peculiar thing in Irish culture that says we can say what we like within, you know, within the confines of this room, but you're not to say it outside, so you don't air the dirty laundry. We kid ourselves, of course, because people know and people do need to say things. But I think those things are still very much alive and well. And I was just listening to Edna there. One of the things that strikes me is one of my pet hates these days. If I can have a minute on my own soapbox, I just think the loss, for instance, of good journalism in Ireland is very evident. What we have these days are columnists. And I'm never quite sure why people in newspapers think that I want to know their opinion about things. Because I'd much rather hear somebody like Edna O'Brien's opinion about Ireland. Because she you know, over so many years, she actually has got theories about why things happen. It's not just an opinion, if you know what I mean.
You know, I endorse all of that, but you also remind me of Yeats's dictum, Irish poets, learn your trade, sing whatever is well made, scorn the sort now growing up, all out of shape from toe to top. Edna, do you read Ireland today? Do you read the younger poets and novelists? And who are you finding in touch with the primal Ireland that you love?
Seamus Heaney has a very strong sense of his roots, and his poetry I find valuable. It sounds like a jewelry. It moves me, and I know that he's a very serious poet. There's a young girl in Ulster, Maeve McGuigan, as well. A lot of the poets in Ireland, Derek Mahan, seem to be the North has spawned them. There are probably some in the South, but at this moment, I cannot. There are very good prose writers.
John Banville is a big man in this country.
John Banville is a very, very interesting, a quite different writer in a way. He's more. What is the word when somebody lives in the mind more than in the passions? But he has his own territory.
Cerebral,
exactly.
Nabokovian.
But one of the things just cropped up in my mind of what we've been talking about, Rebecca mentioned the word brutal, and that I have been called brutal. I think a writer must never shy away from the themes that are the deepest and very often the most brutal, but the way to render them through the metier of prose or poetry must be as beautiful as any great piece of music. Not in terms of seducing or wooing the reader, but because language is the greatest tool, gift, call it what you will, that man has been given. And to standardize that, as happens a great deal now, or to have any slackness in it, is criminal, in my opinion. I think Irish poets learn your trade. All poets learn your trade, but even more significantly, keep learning your trade. Mm. You don't just learn it and then everything is hunky-dory. Each line, each passage, each paragraph that one writes has to be worked at and rewritten again and again. And that is, there's a wonderful story of Samuel Beckett, whom I revere. Mm. He was asked once why Joyce was so great. He said, it's very simple. He makes the words do the work. And I think Ireland is full of story, and no writer need be have any shortage there. But what we want is that constant dedication to what you called earlier and what I happily call the vocation of writing. Now, we live in a world and in times, alas, as we three people know, where writing is very marginalized. People want noise, they want music, they want videos, they want iPods. Fine, I'm not telling them they mustn't have that. But it's at our peril and the peril of future generations if writing and great literature gets ignored.
And that's why I said at the beginning, and I mean it from the heart, this is all the pleasures of reading in the middle of the night for your soul, for your eye, for your ear, for everything in the work of Edna O'Brien, and most especially including The Light of Evening. Thank you for joining us. Come back early and often, anytime. Edna O'Brien. You can keep talking about Edna O'Brien or Ireland or literature. You can help us work on the next shows at radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, training practitioners and students for leadership in human rights. RadioOpenSource.org is hosted by Contegix, Contegix.com. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Murray, Robin Amer, and Greta Pemberton, with help from Jessica Miller, John LaRue, and Rob Keir. Mike Wilkins was our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.